Welcome to Tardi Macha, Nachiome with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rena Foreman, and today we will be studying Yecheskel, Perek Mem Bet, Chapter 42. In the last couple of Prakim, we followed Yecheskel, led by Mr. Tape Measure, on a virtual tour of the Mikdash. Earlier in the Sefer, Yecheskel followed God as God showed him the Tohuvot performed in the confines of the Mikdash and the ensuing destruction of Yerushalayim. But now, Yecheskel and the nation, they are on the other side of things. The destruction is behind them, and now the focus is on rebuilding. This is a vision that brings home the new reality. There will be a final Mikdash. Perek Mem Bet is the third in a series of Prakim in which Yecheskel narrates the details of the vision he sees of the third Beit HaMikdash. The setting, back in the beginning of Perek Mem, describes the date in which this vision took place. Here is the pasuk. Be'esrim v'chamesh shana legalutenu, b'rosh hashana be'esor l'chodesh. So, let's see. This nevuah takes place on the 25th year, counting from our galut. Presumably, that means the galut of Yechaniah. And the nevuah takes place b'rosh hashana, on the 10th of the month. In that context, the words b'rosh hashana would seem to mean toward the beginning of the year, on the 10th of the month. Of course, it wouldn't be exactly the beginning of the year. It would be 10 days in, but you get the idea. 10 days into a year is B'rosh HaShanah because it's toward the beginning of that year. So, while that might be the simple meaning of the words, Rashi quotes Chazal as interpreting the term B'rosh HaShanah more literally, as the actual day of the beginning of the year, which means the dates don't quite add up. As Rashi puts it, since when does the first of the year fall out on the 10th of the month? Leading Rashi to tell us, well, there is in fact a year that begins from the 10th of the first month. That would be the year of the Yovel. Because the Yovel, the Jubilee year, according to the Chumash, it is proclaimed on the 10th of the month on Yom Kippur. On Yovel, which occurs every 50 years, all slaves and land go back to their original owners. Rashi writes at length to show that these words at the beginning of Perek Mem indicate that the year of this vision actually coincides with what would have been the Yovel year had we still been keeping count of the Yovel years at the time, which we haven't been since we were exiled from the land. Yovel doesn't mix with exile. You need a sovereign nation in their land for Yovel to take place. But still, in all, as Rashi reads it, the Pasuk seems to think that somehow it is important for us to know that this year, the year of this vision, if we did the math, would have been a Yovel year. It's kind of a phantom Yovel. What could possibly be the reason behind this? Well, let's think about that. Let's go back in time a little. If the year of this vision would have been a Yovel year that wasn't, do we know anything about the Yovel that occurred 50 years before this, the last moment that Yovel was kept? We do know something about it, and the truth is, according to Rashi, the very beginning of Sefer Yecheskel also begins with an allusion to Yovel, and that was the last Yovel that was kept before exile. It's almost like our Sefer is bookended with allusions to Yovel. Let's take a look at that pasuk, the opening of Sefer Yecheskel. Vahi b'shloshim shana b'revi'i b'chamisha l'chodesh v'ani b'toch ha'gola. On the 30th year, on the 4th, the 5th of the month. Yecheskel's nevuah started on the 30th year, but we don't hear clearly the 30th year of what. Rashi takes the position that it means the 30th year since the last Yovel before this. And that was actually the last Yovel that was kept. It was in the times of the king Yoshiyahu when he read aloud from the Torah that he had found, which was opened to the words of the Tochacha. As it happens, those very words of the Tochacha became the theme for that moment in history, and they are indeed a constant refrain throughout Sefer Yecheskel as well, as Yecheskel uses them to punctuate a terrible bringing of exile upon the people. These words that Yoshiyahu saw heralded the breaking apart of the kingdom and of Israel's independence. And now, pause a minute and think about what Yovel is really all about. It was fitting, in a way, that the last Yovel coincided with when Yoshiyahu saw the Tochacha, this omen of the coming of exile. Because Yovel inaugurates a time when individuals leave slavery and come back to their ancestral land, And this moment was the end of that practice in a big way. Because when it comes to the community as a whole, the nation of Israel in total, once the Churban came, there really would be no Yovel, so to speak, for the community for many hundreds of years. They will be exiled from their ancestral land and will go into slavery among the nations. And when are they really coming home? Yes, for a brief moment in time, the second Beit HaMikdash would rise and then be destroyed. But never is there really a Yovel kind of redemption for the community, a chance to come home from slavery and for the nation to come back to its ancestral land and truly attain sovereignty and independence. For even in Second Temple times, the kings of Israel served at the pleasure of other emperors, first Persia, then Greece, and Rome. And soon enough, full destruction would come again, as Rome destroyed the second Mikdash. Indeed, 50 years, then 100, then 150, will all pass without any let-up from this terrible exile. And now think about these words at the end of Yechezkel, these words that are bookends to the beginning. The counterpart to Yechezkel's first prophecy, the prophecy we are now reading about in Yechezkel Perek Mem, it takes place in what would have been the next Yovel year. And what does it tell of? It tells of a moment in the future where the Yovel promise is fully met. Indeed, what Yovel promises for the individual, the prophecy of Yechezkel will inaugurate for the entire community. Yovel promises that individual slaves will be set free, and ancestral land will return to its owner. That will now happen for the entire community. The community which is enslaved will be set free, and the community as a whole will return to Israel, its ancestral land. And the final step in that process is the building of the third and permanent home for Hashem, which we will continue to learn about in our parak. In this parak, Yechezkel's tour transitions from the Mikdash itself to the outer courtyard, HaChatzer HaChitzonah, and there he encounters Lishkaot, inner chambers. We get a cryptic description of these chambers and their placement. The psukim in our parak are one of those places in which Rashi and Radak, the Mefarshim we count on to make meaning, seem to struggle to figure it all out. Rashi here says, "Va'ani lo yacholti lahavin, ani lo hayali rav, v'lo zer bechol habinyan hazeh." I couldn't understand. I didn't have a rebbe, a teacher, who could help me with this. And Radak, sharing this sentiment, suggests, "Parsha zu atid Eliyahu leparsha." This parsha will ultimately only be explicated at the time of Eliyahu Hanavi. But even if the exact external details of these lishkaot are elusive, there's one thing that is clear from the psukim. These psukim clue us in to the unique role of these lishkaot, and they do that with the use of a milah hamancha, a lead word. Let's dive in, starting in Pasuk Yud Gimel, and listen out for it. Hine lishkot hakodesh, asher yomklu shem hakohanim, asher krovim lashem, kodshei hakodeshim, sham yanichu, Kodshei HaKodashim, V'amincha, V'achatat, V'asham, Ki HaMakom Kadosh, B'vo'am HaKohanim, V'lo Yitzu Me'HaKodesh, El HaChatzer HaChitzonah, V'sham Yanichu Bigdehem, Asher Yishartu Bahen, Ki Kodesh Hema, V'levshu B'gadim Achirim, V'karvu El Asher La'am. Yes, it's the word Kadosh, holy, which takes center stage here. The holy Kodesh Lishka'ot, there, only the Kohanim, who are close to Hashem, can eat the Kodshei Kodashim, the Holy of Holies. There, in these Lishkaot, they will place the Kodshei Kodashim, Holy of Holies, the Mincha, Chata, and Hashem offerings, because the place is Kadosh, holy. When the Kohanim entered, they should not leave from the Kodesh, this holy place, to the outer courtyard while wearing these clothes. There, in the Lishka, they should leave these clothes, which they used in the service, because their clothes, that is, are kadosh, holy. They shall wear these other clothes as they approach the nation. We have 8 iterations of the word kadosh in just the space of these couple of psukim. The text seems to be trying to tell us something with the preponderance of the word kadosh in these psukim. And to see what that might be, let's take a closer look at the 2 laws that we learn from these psukim. The psukim, interspersed with that word kodesh, explain that it is only in these lishkaot that the Kohanim will eat their share of the Kodshei Kodashim, such as the Mincha, Chatat, and Asham. Now, a similar law existed in the Torah. In the earlier temples, too, the Kohanim were limited to eating their share of korbanot in a holy place. But here is the difference. In Sefer Vayikra, Bimkom Kadosh, B'chatzar Ol Moed Yochluha. In the Torah, the holy place can be anywhere in the chatzar, in the courtyard. But here, in our parak, there is an added restriction. Only the Lishkaot are considered holy enough spaces for the Kohanim to eat the Kodesh Kodeshim. Here in Beit Shlishi, the Kohanim seem to be more limited than they were in the original Mikdashim. Why would that be? Let's keep that in the back of our minds as we continue reading these psukim and take a closer look at the other law regarding the Kohanim that we find described here. In this new Mikdash, there are laws that pertain to the holiness of the clothing of the Kohanim. The begadim, the clothing the Kohanim wore in the holy service, that clothing was considered holy, and therefore the Kohanim were to change their clothing and leave them in the Lishkaot, in these chambers, before leaving to the Chatzer to greet the nation. It almost seems as though their clothing needs to stay in the Lishkaot for fear of these begadim, these clothes, being defiled somehow by interfacing with the nation. So we have the word Kodesh used multiple times here, and some new laws that seem to set the tone for an even higher level of Kedusha in this third Bayit. So we have the third Kodesh used multiple times here, and some new laws that seem to set the tone for an even higher level of Kedusha in this third Bayit. What are we to make of that? Could there in fact be something holier about this Mikdash? Something that transcends the Kedusha of the first two houses of Hashem? Possibly. For now, the jury is out on that one. In the meantime, back to the psukim. As the parak progresses, Yechezkel's tour of the Mikdash comes to a close. Back in Parak Mem, Yechezkel's virtual tour started at the eastern gate of the outer courtyard. Vayavo el shar asher panav derech hakadima. He came in through the eastern-facing gate, and now the tour ends in the same place it started, also at the eastern gate of the outer courtyard. Yechezkel says, V'chila et midot habayit hapnimi v'hotzi'ani derech hashar asher panav derech hakadim. When he, this little angelic figure, finished measuring the inner house, he took me out through the eastern-facing gate. Yechezkel watches as the four ruchot, the four sides of the structure, are measured. They form a square structure, a perfect square. By the way, this language, Arba Ruchot, we encountered those words not too long ago. You may recall those words from Perek Lamed Zion. Remember when the dry bones were reconstituted, but still had no life in them? Ve'ein bo ruach, God at the time told Yechezkel, in order to bring these bones to life, well, you've got to invoke the wind. Let the ruach of the spirit come from four sides and breathe life into these slain figures. So now, it's almost as if the Mikdash is erected from this new life that had been blown into these bones when they first came to life. It's kind of like this Mikdash, structured with four ruchot, four walls, is the ultimate rebirth of these dry bones, which ruach, life, was blown into from four ruchot, four corners, or sides of the earth. And getting back to the idea we talked about in the last parak, the nature of Hashem's house mirrors the house that the people find themselves resident in. Here in Yechezkel, the era of the third Mikdash is ushered in when God brings us back from the four ruchot to our grand national house, the land of Israel. And now we reciprocate by building a house for God from the same Arba Ruchot, the same four sides. Maybe this third Mikdash is the ultimate redemption of these bones. As the parak ends, we encounter that word Kodesh one last time. Here is this last pasuk in our parak. Chomalo saviv saviv. Orech chamesh ma'ot v'rochav chamesh ma'ot lahavdil ben hakodesh l'chol. There is a choma, a wall, which surrounds the entire structure. Its purpose is to separate between the kodesh, the holiness of the bayit, from the chol, the regular mundane life around it. The Mikdash is a self-contained entity. So, what happens in the Mikdash stays in the Mikdash, at least when it comes to kodesh, to holiness. And the choma, The wall that surrounds it, Saviv Saviv, is meant to guard it, if you will, from the intrusion by the mundane world around it. That choma, the first thing that was carefully measured at the beginning of Yechezkel's tour of the Mikdash, is once again mentioned at the end of the tour. That choma, the first thing that was carefully measured at the beginning of Yechezkel's tour of the Mikdash, is once again mentioned at the end of the tour. The choma, with checkpoints saviv saviv all around, will be there to keep the Kodesh safe from encroachment by the mundane, the everyday world. On the one hand, the Mikdash needs to have its own inviolable boundaries so as to maintain its purity and status as Hashem's special domain in the world. And only then, only once the temple is pure, spiritually and morally, free of toivot, can the Mikdash become what it is supposed to become, a magnet for Israel and the nations of the world to come to a central location to worship Hashem. The boundary of the wall of the Choma sets the stage for God's Shechina to enter this Mikdash through the same eastern gate through which the Shechina left all the way back in the early part of the Sefer. At the end of Perek Yud Aleph, we had this verse, V'yal kvod Hashem me'al toch ha'ir, v'yamod al ha'har asher mikedem le'ir. The kavod, the glory of Hashem, left from the mountain that was to the east of the city. And now, as we will see in the beginning of the next Perek, God's kavod, his Shechina, will enter through that same eastern gate. V'yulicheni el ha'shar, shar asher poneh derech ha'kadim, v'hine kavod Elokei Yisrael, ba miderech ha'kadim. Yechezkel says, he, this figure, led me to the eastern-facing gate, and there was the kavod of Hashem, the God of Israel, coming from the east. All of this echoes the way humans interacted with the original special place of Hashem, the garden, Gan Eden. The pathway in and out of the garden was through the east. It was at the eastern gate of the garden, so to speak, that the original Kruvim were set up as guardians. Vayashken mikedem leGan Eden, et haKruvim ve'elad hacherev hamitapechet, lishmor et derech etz haChayim. God's special place, inasmuch as it really is separate from the world around it, always needs guarding to maintain its purity and its own unique character. The world outside can't encroach upon it. If this job was done by angelic beings in the original Gan, it is done by a wall here in the third Beit HaMikdash. But the wall, the Choma, had some help. It too was guarded by someone, by Kohanim, who served as guards. This special role of the Kohanim will become a focus of the next Prakim in Yechezkel. Thank you for studying together, Le'ilu Nishmat, Riva Schwab, Rivka Bat Alexander Sender.